might this remove sort of background like a white noise. So this is what we're going to do. I'm just going to do like a really quick kind of précis just in case the rest got muddled. Okay.
So yeah, the fan's the turning off, back up again now that the video is going again.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm moving this away.
All right. Well, let's just try. We'll try. Listen, we'll just try.
Okay.
We'll do what we can and then we'll see. Okay. So I'm here with Ashley Booth, who's the most amazingly experienced clinician I know in psychedelics. And she's been telling me about the difference between 5-MeO-DMT and NMDMT is in ayahuasca, and if you take it on your own, you might see elves and lots of things. And with 5-MeO, we're talking really about a more mystical experience that I know Ashley has had a lot of experience with, and I know it was a big deal in your psychedelic journey personally and professionally. So it's you took this how many years ago years first?
Now. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. So 10 years ago,
yeah, so,
you took it, and what happened?
I like to get a little quiet when I talk about this because I don't want it to just turn into a story. Because it was the most impactful experience of my life and has changed the course of my life. And so, you know, going from being a pretty radical atheist most of my life to then agnostic when I started using psychedelics to having this full-blown mystical experience of feeling the most profound love and the most profound compassion for the human experience. And basically, there was a question in my heart that said, is there a God? And this presence answered me and it said yes. And so like it's still if I can tap into it, you know, I can, it still brings tears to my eyes because it's something that I'm continuing to integrate every day since then and will continue to do that for the rest of my life.
Thank you. And thank you for saying that thing of, you know, wanting to go slow with it, because I know I was rushing in with the intro, but I really understand, because when I talk to other people about my 5 experience, and I've had a few, but there was one that was really seminal, I find it hard to talk about in normal conversation because you sort of want to change the register, the conversation, because you don't want to sort of rattle on about something that's so deep, and how to even talk about these experiences, you know, is a good question, and I think speaks to the difficulty of integration and obviously the power of the experiences. I can relate on the sense that I'd never had an experience so big.
Infinitely
I think
big.
That would be the word I would use. And I am a seeker of very big experiences. Right? I don't know, like a small life or anything like that, right? I mean, I think you and I, like, you're not in psychedelics if you're somebody who's interested in a contracted life.
Well, and what I was going to say is just like, you know, I think anyone that's considering taking this substance, and I'm sure we'll get more into this, but please, if you're going to do that, do it with somebody that's trained and knows what they're doing. But to be able to know that you need to make a lot of potential space afterwards, like a lot, because I had the most profoundly positive experiences that I could have, and it was still quite challenging to, you know, I started so many, went and did all of these different things and met all these new people and all these programs within the first year, just because I just didn't have a context. But for people that have challenging experiences, you know, it can take even more space and time to be able to work through.
Absolutely. And it's hard to... Yeah, it's hard to know what to do with these expansions, and they show up in different ways. For example, with my big experience, I'm still integrating it. I think I'll be integrating it till the day I die, because I, you know, it was so profound. I can't imagine it just becoming something that doesn't move me whenever I think about it. But it's weird. Like, I still am a bit scared of heights. And I'd say it's a kind of an agoraphobia. Like, if I was driving on that PCH road up to Big Sur, and, you know, you've got that big expanse, there's always part of me that's like, I'm going to fall off the road, or I want to fall off the road, or, you know what I mean? It's sort of like this weird sort of death, titillation, overwhelm kind of feeling. And, you know, it turned out in my 5-MeO DMT experience, the one that was so profound, I actually went into a vast space and I had nothing to hold on to. I was kind of flying in this space, feeling incredibly expanded and incredibly excited and feeling incredibly free. It was sort of like being filled with the most beautiful kind of bravery and freedom. And okay, so that was wonderful. Cut to like 2 years later, and I'm driving down this icy road from seeing the sequoias, and I'm on my own. And there are these big vistas out there. And so I'm thinking, oh shit, here we go. Now I'm going to get in a panic, you know, now my palms are going to start sweating. Now I'm going to be like, oh, and it kind of didn't happen. And then I looked out again and it wasn't like it was completely gone, but it had changed. And I was like, what's going on? And I think I still don't really understand it, but I think it is different now. When I look at those vast spaces, I'm a bit more comfortable with them. And I suppose I got exposed to a fear.
Well, the other thing that comes to mind is like, it causes you to have a very different relationship with death. And so, you know, that there's something bigger than what's happening here on this plane of reality. And pretty much any psychedelics and in DMT, 5-MeO DMT is going to make you question that and feel different types of things. And so I wonder if that different relationship with death and our lives and how we interact with it might be something else at play there.
Oh, I think that's such a good point. And as you were saying that, I was realizing my relationship with death has definitely changed. I used to be super terrified. Then I went into a kind of numb neutral. And then, yeah, I think over the course of psychedelics, particularly with the 5, I've noticed I talk about death more. I actually have fun with the idea of death more. Like, I joke about it a lot more. And I'm always saying to people, we're only here for 5 minutes. I enjoy that statement now in a way. It's me, which is weird. And yeah, I think there's more excitement, less fear, maybe more interest, which is super helpful.
Well, it's such a
wow.
You know, I think the underpinning of many of the mental health issues that we have are not having a relationship with how we're living or how we're thinking about death and what we spend our time on before we get to that place. And so, you know, this medicine and the work that I've done with it has really informed my therapeutic practice, obviously. I'm a therapist because I had that experience, so that's maybe another piece of the story. But you know, everything comes down to some sort of existential question that we need to come into some sort of relationship with.
Why are we here? Question, like grappling with that.
What are we doing here? What is this place?
Why are we, by the way? I mean, that's what I was hoping we would get to on this podcast. Can you tell us why we're here, Ashley? I mean, surely you know by now.
Well, here's my take on that. I think that we are all each writing our own stories and about what the human experience is. And so we get to do that firsthand. And we also get to learn things and the wisdom of other people to write our own stories, our own user manuals. And so, I mean, I think that that's kind of one piece of it. And so being here so that we can experience all the breadth of what it means to be human, not just to be happy or to be, to feel all of it, to be able to have the courage and the presence to feel all of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Courage is a great word. It is a lot at times, isn't it?
Yeah.
Feeling all of it.
And I think we're all feeling that coming out of, you know, these last few years. It's been hard for pretty much everyone that I know. So.
Yeah. Yeah. No, there's no question about that. So yes, how can we love the hard as we go and enjoy it? So if my experience, we're just obviously, you know, drastically reducing here, but like if my experience made me a little less afraid of death, what would you say your experience did for you? Would it be the same?
I mean, the death piece is a part of it, but I think that's not really the main crux of it for me. It's really more about like connecting that the foundational frequency of the universe is love. And so like I've never really loved the word faith for a lot of different reasons, but I'm learning to reclaim that word. Mm-hmm. And so I'm approaching life more with curiosity and that like, how is this going to turn out? How is this, even though this is incredibly challenging right now, what is in store for me here? What is this? How is love going to come through me and out of me? And how can I get out of the way for that love to come through me and out of me? So that I can embody the value of love and courage and compassion. So, it's made me much more value driven, service oriented. And it's really been especially over these last few years, been a soothing, I don't even know what to call it. I mean, it's faith. It's being able to connect and to know that there's something, faith is like without having proof. And I feel like I have had proof. I've been able to have a direct mystical experience, right? Faith is for people that somebody else had a mystical experience and then they're just believing what that other person told them. And so maybe
you're talking about embodied faith,
trust,
real direct experience, trust, maybe. So, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, all these concepts have been something that have been big parts of my integration process. So yeah, mm-hmm. really just seeing through the eyes of this bigger picture has been so impactful. I mean, I can't put any more words to it.
Yeah, no, you've given some very good words to it. Thank you. I know that you were, I'm imagining, first of all, this personal experience led you to your work mm-hmm. in the clinic in Mexico, was it a detox clinic, addiction breaking clinic? Was that right?
It was a Ibogaine clinic for detox, but I ran there, or I was a psycho-spiritual retreat mm-hmm. leader there. So I wasn't working with the people doing the detox programs, but people were interested in doing Ibogaine for psycho-spiritual reasons. And then we offered them 5-MeO DMT afterwards. And so I did for the prep and integration for them for the Ibogaine, and then I facilitated the 5-MeO down there.
Okay, so for people who are listening who are now wondering what Ibogaine is, let's do
sure.
Quick on Ibogaine, and then so I'd love Ibogaine to get into what you were witnessing.
I believe 12 or 14 alkaloids that are found in the plant Iboga, which is a psychedelic plant from West Africa. And it's been used for thousands and thousands of years. It's the root bark of this shrub. And it's a psychedelic experience like no other. So what's interesting about it is that it resets the serotonin and dopamine system of your brain. And so for people that have had opiate addictions, it can actually reset their nervous system and help them detox, and then maybe also offering them a psychedelic experience that makes them rethink maybe or get support to move through the trauma that maybe drove them to the addiction. So that's my...
Thank you. Wonderful, wonderful. Okay, so at the end of these detox treatments, there was an option of taking the 5-MeO-DMT.
The, yeah, the detox program.
Is that right?
As well. Mm-hmm.
Okay, but 5-MeO is not a detox situation. Okay. But yeah, I imagine it supports recovery. Is that correct?
You know, I mean, the first step in AA is to connect to a higher power. So that's what 5-MeO does. And so, and
yeah,
just that small thing. Well, and just as a side note, you know, the person that Bill Wilson that started AA, he started it, but then when he tried LSD, he actually thought that LSD should be part of the 12-step program because it helped people connect with a higher power. That was shuffled under the rug, obviously, but anyway, so that's part of the rationale.
Mm-hmm. That makes a lot of sense. So what were you noticing when you were, what would you call it, hosting, guiding these experiences?
What did I notice?
Facilitating. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
How were people being helped? What were they experiencing?
It's very reliable. It's a very reliable medicine in that, you know, because Ibogaine, I would say maybe a third or a fourth of the people got something out of it. And which is a little bit of a tricky thing to support people with when they spent like a lot of money to come down and have this experience. And they mostly came down for the Ibogaine. Yeah. And then the 5-MeO was something they hadn't even heard of. And that ended up being the most important piece of it because it is so impactful. So, I mean, big catharsis, big insights into mystical experiences, experiences of knowing that they are also part of God, that they are God. Like we are, everything is God. Again, mm-hmm. I've reclaimed that word. And so, you know, or, you know, their trauma would come up, but in a way that was much less of a cognitive story and more of something that was playing out in their body releasing. So, stunning, stunning mm-hmm, work. Mm-hmm. And I would say most people, yeah, I mean, like 90, 95% of people had a very impactful experience, which is incredibly gratifying to be able to be a witness to. Yeah.
No kidding. I wish you had filmed it. Sounds so fascinating to me. I have to ask you this, Ashley. What does it mean to reclaim God?
Yeah.
I'm not going to apologize. I keep thinking, say sorry to him. Exactly. I'm like, no, don't say sorry to him. Just ask the question. It's so important, you know? Yeah, yeah.
So I was not raised religiously, really. I mean, maybe sort of Christmas Eve church for a few years as a kid, and that was it. And then eventually I got to be, you know, middle school, and I was like, I don't believe this. I don't want to go. And my parents were like, okay. And then they all stopped going. So it was like, pretty performative to begin with, but in my radical atheist phase, I was just like, how can people believe this stuff? You know, like how can they believe that there's this, you know, father with a beard in the sky that's like so human, and it's like, which of course now I don't believe that either. But to
right, you now know he doesn't necessarily have a beard, right?
It's just everything. Exactly.
Right, right. It's just, or it's the sky.
It's more akin to maybe like how people describe the Tao. So, you know, it's just everything that is the energy that is flowing through everything, that it's, that there is a consciousness, but it is something beyond anything that we can fathom. And so God is the most clear word for what that is to me. And so I have reclaimed that word as opposed, I mean, some people say source or the universe or anything like that. And I felt like I just wanted to reclaim that word. So that's been a journey that's been a part of this as well. Yeah.
Yeah, just a small journey, no big deal. So I know you and I've touched on this before as clinicians, but I have spoken to people, let's say, you know, I'm thinking of this couple who I spoke to where the male in the couple took the 5-MeO, had exactly this kind of mystical life-changing experience, felt opened up, tremendously grateful, can't believe it, et cetera, et cetera. The female in the couple got stuck in a kind of a, gosh, I don't know, I'm just synopsizing here, yeah, paranoid purgatory, a really difficult place, hasn't been able to get out of it. You hear these mm-hmm. stories sometimes, it's scary stuff.
Yes.
What do you think? And please advise.
So what I would say for, there's two things at play here. One, so there's two people that had, that are in a relationship that had an experience that were different, right? And that could be challenging in itself, mm-hmm. or someone that decides yeah. to start using psychedelics and the other person doesn't, and their life starts to go in a completely different direction. And so that was also part of what was challenging mm-hmm. for me in my integration process, because I went to do 5-MeO with my boyfriend and I had this full-blown mystic experience and connecting with God, and he did not. And so he was like embarrassed that I was going to start talking about God, because that was not part of our community's lingo and it was thought down on, and get it. Like I used to be that. And so luckily, you know, shortly after that, he kind of had some other experiences that kind of caught him up a little bit more. And so we were ended up kind of headed in the same direction, but it was very hard for a while. So, I mean, that piece is one mm-hmm. of it. And mm-hmm. so, you know, if a couple is going to go into something, they need to have conversations around that this might be quite different for both of them, and it might bring them more together. It might bring them further apart. And so then that needs to be kind of part of the informed consent in a way. So, and then as far as the woman, the experience that you were talking about with the woman who's what I call that like caught in the birth canal kind of experience, where she's not gone fully through to a full rebirth experience essentially. And, you know, I think you can look at the perinatal stages of Groff that talks about sort of these different stages of the birthing process. And I see those also in the rebirthing process. And so one of those is either stuckness and there's nowhere to go, or there can be a paranoia, like if the baby is not wanted by the family, and like it can feel that, and that there can like be a paranoia that can come with that. Obviously maybe not as a baby, but that's sort of in your cell somehow that gets replaying again. So, you know, whether that's something that is playing out for her that was a recapitulation of something that happened in her birth, or this is something that she needs to finish the process. And so while it is really not what people want to hear, is that the best probably strategy to move through that is to actually go and take the medicine again and to like finish the process. And for some Yikes. People, they don't have the capacity or the time and space to be able to do that. But also at the same time, if they prolong it, it actually makes it worse. So, I mean, you...
Yeah, that makes sense. Also, what about the practitioner? I mean, that's another dimension of this, yeah. because I've taken this with different practitioners, and what it's made me realize is, wow, you know, you get into such a tender state with this medicine, and there can be a tendency when you're in a tender state to kind of imprint in a
For sure.
parental way. And that can be positive, like with all kind of these therapy transferences, it can be positive, but it can also be
and I mean,
dicey.
I've had my own experiences with that. And so, you know, there's so much to navigate when people do have a challenging experience. And I would say that it's not, those challenging experiences are, you know, I don't know, maybe.
Hold on one sec, Ashley. I'm sorry. I'm having another.
Okay.
Something's glitching, and I think it's because my power's running down. Give me one second. That we need in there. I think we can take that one out there. Take this here. Okay, that's good. All right. So,
what was I saying?
All right. So,
yeah.
Practitioner.
So challenging experiences can be, I mean, I wouldn't say that they're super, super common, but I don't know, maybe 20%, some 30% maybe in there. I don't know. And it's a big grip, you know, there are certain people that have very strong negative experiences and then maybe some medium ones. But for someone like that, that has been sort of caught in the birth canal, you know, it does require a lot of space, slowing down, support, you know. And so, you know, if a person is open to it, if they can continue the process, you know, by either doing the medicine again or doing something that allows them to keep the activation going, because it's like the energy is trying to move through them and it's stuck somehow. And so it needs to be able to move through. If they don't have the capacity to allow that in their life at this time, then you can use interventions like benzodiazepines that just sort of like shut down the process. You know, I think this is also part of the sort of informed consent. Like it can be destabilizing, but I haven't seen anyone go through even the most extreme experiences and not get to the other side with a gift that came out of it. So it's worth it.
Yeah, I think we're back to
exactly.
We're back at faith in a way, right? Because I think, you know, it takes me back to the sort of the, you know, the old models of fear around psychedelics, like, you know, you're going to throw yourself out of a window on LSD, or you're going to have a psychotic break. You know, look, it can happen. But the old model of mental health, I would say, is about like, there are these places where you can get stuck. I think that stuck, like existentially stuck forever, and it's bad. Whereas I feel like the psychedelic model is, oh yeah, there are places, there'll be places you go, but there's always this gravitational pull towards wholeness. There's always this wholeness that we can get to, but yes, it may require a bunch of interventions. It may require a bunch of other people. It may require pain, but it's possible for every individual. I mean, look, I might be existentially wrong, but this is what I feel like I'm discovering, that so much of what faith is about is keeping that model of wholeness in mind.
Well, and it is also what I was saying earlier around, like, this is about us having the human experience. And so it's not just like, oh, now I'm like, great, right? It's the hero's journey. And part of the hero's journey is having these dark experiences or feeling stuck. Like I tell people, stuckness is a stage in the hero's journey. It may not feel like you're moving, but it is a stage, and there's something there that needs to be learned before you can move on. And
I've been telling myself that about January and February this year. I'm like, this stagnation and stodginess you're feeling is just part of your wonderful year that's coming your way. Yeah, sure. Exactly. What are we going to do? We have to be creative with what we've got. And with a sense of humor, 100%, 100%. Okay, so on a pragmatic level, say you're either you got stuck and had a difficult experience, or you just want to try this in a safe way. How the heck would somebody go about finding a good 5-MeO guide facilitator?
I mean, I think the rule of thumb is the same for most, you're going to sit with anyone, like making sure that they're trained in some kind of way. So asking them what their training is. So I'm sure what I've done in the past is I started the Psychedelic Society of Southern California, the AWARE Project, and we put together a guide on there that's kind of questions you should ask yourself before, you know, working in the underground, essentially. And so that might be questions that you need to ask yourself before you think about doing this, questions you should ask a facilitator, and questions the facilitator should ask you. So, you know, they should be asking you about your health conditions, you know, what's your mental health background? You know, these are kind of questions that if they're not asking that they're probably not doing their due diligence. What medication you might be on, those kinds of things.
That's super helpful because there is this sense of, you know, hey, we're just going off grid. So we're just going to go crazy off grid. I mean, that was my approach to psychedelics initially because there wasn't this kind of information around. I was just like, just throw myself in the deep end.
Well, and I think what's tricky too, that when people are not, have not, you know, are kind of just wanting to get into the psychedelic community or to be able to get, you know, and they don't have a lot of access either to people or substances, they'll find, you know, someone will connect them with to someone that will connect them with someone. And they're like, oh my God, I finally found someone. And there's this scarcity mindset that, okay, this is the only person that I've found so far, so I have to sit with them because there's no one else. And so maybe even if there are some red flags where I feel a little uncomfortable around them, I'm still going to work with them because I can't find anywhere else. And obviously that can come up with some problems, or it may come up with some learning lessons that you may need to learn. So that can be a piece of it. And I just want to encourage people that like, listen to your gut, you know, or bring up your concerns with the person that you're going to potentially sit with, because that needs to be a conversation.
Right, right, exactly. And if you bring up a concern and somebody who's going to facilitate you can't make space for it, because sometimes that can happen. It's like this sort of subtle or not so subtle kind of gaslighting, which is like...
Right.
Well, that's just your fear talking or whatever. You know, if there's no respect for fear and there's no respect for your position, you know,
well, and it's
run
also
for the hills.
People where they're at, right? Because, you know, like, so I work in the internal family systems model of therapy, which believes, you know, it posits that we have different parts of us. Like one part of me wants to eat that pizza and the other part of me is like, don't eat the pizza. It's not healthy for you. Right. So we all have these like idea that we have parts of ourselves that conflict. And so when people come to me with their fears, and I talk about this in a lot of the psychedelic integration and teaching that I do, we talk about what are the concerns that are coming up for people. Right. And so those are their protective systems. Those are parts of them that are trying to keep them safe, but may be not so well informed. And so they, you know, people's protectors might say things like, parts of them might say, like, I'm afraid I'm going to go crazy. Okay, well, let's talk about that. Like, so here's sort of the risk factors. Here are things that you might have heard that aren't true. Here are some certain things that, you know, if you have a history of psychosis in your family, or you're below the age of 25 and you do have this history, then maybe wait. So it's being able to, good facilitators will ask people good questions around what their concerns are and really meet them where they're at and give them the information for them to make an informed choice.
That's super helpful. I do have a lingering question, which is how do we resolve the pizza dilemma?
I haven't figured that one out yet. I've already gotten a vegan pizza, but
that's where the big bucks are. How much, 5 MEO does it take to resolve the question of whether to eat pizza? I say eat pizza. Life is short. That's my opinion. But but okay, that's really helpful. I like that. We're talking about research and due diligence. And how do you see 5-MeO on the map of psychedelics and psychedelic science? Is this something do you think is working its way towards legitimacy? Should it be
good
there?
Questions.
What's the future? Tell us the future.
Yeah. So there are a couple groups that are USONA and Beckley SciTech that are doing research on 5-MeO-DMT for clinical indications, specifically depression. I have been involved in a consultant for Beckley SciTech doing their therapist training manual, and I've been trained by them and I've given them a lot of feedback, and they're trying to get their study moved through California. So people are trying to move it into a clinical realm, and I see that as a way to try to create some kind of framework, hopefully a safe framework, to be able to slowly reintroduce these psychedelic substances back into Western culture. However, you know, in my heartest of hearts, I don't believe that 5-MeO belongs in a clinical setting. Like I will be a part of it, and I want to help them do the research in as best an ethical way as possible based off of my experience. But I believe that it does fit better in a more spiritual container and a spiritual model. And I think therapy, especially psychedelic therapy, is more a part of the conversation is people's spirituality and how they relate to themselves and the world. But yeah, if the future that I want to create is that we have psychedelic community churches, for lack again another word that I've reclaimed, that are places where people can come and do psychedelics in community with support from elders and peers and to be able to get that reflection, catharsis, reconnection to values, all the things that church has typically stood for over time, like an important piece of what we need as humans. And that people that maybe have more extreme things that they're needing to deal with, trauma, extreme mental health conditions, then they would be the ones that maybe go to the psychedelic therapists that are like more highly trained. And so that's what I would like to see in the future, and what I'm participating in creating, helping move us in that direction, because we need to decentralize our connection to the spiritual and being able to have a safe place for us to be able to do that, and a community to hold us and support us, and that we're all growing and together. That's what I vision into the future.
Well, what a beautiful vision. And you know, count me in. Seriously, I mean, I completely agree with you. And it makes me think of an exchange I had with a healer recently who was talking about the difference between trauma or re-traumatization and initiation. And she was saying, you know, you could have the same experience, but if you re-experience trauma on your own, you're just getting re-traumatized. If you re-experience trauma in loving connection, that can be an initiation. So I feel like there are all these beautiful initiations possible from traveling through trauma, and that togetherness is the new model. I, as a therapist, and I'm sure you have some relationship to this too, it's a bit of a lonely old model, this one-on-one thing. It's beautiful and it's sacred, but it's not enough. Yes. It's not enough for today's world. So, you know, you answered my final question, which is, what is your wish for the future? but is there anything else? Is there anything else you'd like to add? Yeah, and also, sure. Where can we find you if you want to be found?
Is there anything else that I want to say? Yeah, be curious, be kind to one another, you know? I mean, we're all just trying to make our way through this world, and that these medicines are here to help, you know? And it's all God. And so if we're not seeing it as God, then it's something that we need to think much more deeply about. Yeah. And where people can find me? Yes, my website is
Would you like us to find you?
.net, ashleybooth.net. And then check out the Aware Project, awareproject.org. We have all of our old, we've been doing salons monthly for years and years. And so all of them are on YouTube, and we have a lot of information on the website. So check that out too.
Amazing. It's such a pleasure to be having this conversation with you. You were one of the first people I met as I tiptoed into psychedelic community quite a long time ago. No, it's great to be here now. Thank you so much for coming on the show. It's really great. I'm going to stop the recording, and then I just want you to hang out for a second.